For people who are concerned about being degenerate, I feel like the Nuts Bowls are really, like, absolutely not... I mean, it's not any different than the, like, alt-right 4chan, you know, anime Nazi shit that you see anywhere else. And I'm wondering if that's, like, is that the Americanization of the Nuts Bowl aesthetic? Or is that just, like, is that it's just as good as it gets in the age of the internet? Anime Nazi teen or vaguely teen-ish girl... all, you know, saluting Kim Jong-un. It's really weird. Like, I cannot get my head around the aesthetics of this thing. You know, I remember encountering Nuts Bowls, like, on the internet in, like, the early 2000s, and they struck me as, like, serious political people who had, like, right-wing politics. Then this other thing just seems to be, like, I don't know, just so much more farcical.
Hello, and welcome to The Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Jason.
And I'm Jenny.
And today we are taking up the delightful task of talking about fascist anti-capitalism and why you shouldn't be so confused by it, but should definitely still hate it just as much as regular fascism.
You know, this, I think it was just this week that, like, Tucker Carlson and Ann Coulter both came out and, like, said something, like, you know, being like, hey, we should be more critical of capitalism or you know, some shit like that. And I really, really, really wish that every time that something like this happened, like, the entirety of the internet left wouldn't respond by going, Comrade Coulter? Question mark?
Oh, God, yeah, I saw that a couple of times.
Yeah, like, the one that I've seen a lot is just people being like, yo, this timeline is lit. It's like, I mean, it is, but not because it's confusing and weird, but because it's, you know, it's scary. It's because we've seen this before.
Yeah, we've been
so
here.
I guess what Ann Coulter said was that she agreed with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's idea that the rich need to be taxed at 70%. And she said something along the lines of, like, let's start with the Koch brothers or something. Mm. And Tucker Carlson said that conservatives need to stop idolizing capitalism.
Yeah, and in that same speech, he also talked about the decline of the American family and how, you know, women don't marry men who make less money than them. And so that's causing a decline in, like, marriage rates, which is a... sowing the seeds of moral degeneracy. And, you know, if you look at the whole speech, it is pretty lit. I'll give him that. Or like, okay. Well,
but, and he frequently will pull that, like, you know, I care about all of America and, you know, I care about American workers, we need to take immigration seriously as an issue because the people who are primarily impacted by immigration are not the, you know, the elite liberals or whatever, Hollywood elites and all these types. It's the American working class. He uses a lot of that kind of, like, appeal to to worker consciousness.
Yeah, it's so,
and honestly,
does,
like,
so does Richard Trumka from the AFL-CIO. He was like, stop the Trump Mexican bailout.
So,
yikes.
Tucker Carlson is one of the few people that everyone calls a fascist where I'm not so quick to disagree with him and to correct them. I'm like, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, he might be a fascist. He's in Father Coughlin territory.
Wasn't it, it was Tucker Carlson's show that Angela Nagel came on to talk about the, like, the left case, mm-hmm, for the so-called left case for closed borders.
Yeah. That was infinitely worse than her article, was her going on Tucker Carlson.
Yeah.
Because taking that out of that context, her article is just, you know, sort of right social democracy. That's like the view of, you know, tons of people in social democratic parties going back, you know, 100 years, and it would be nothing remarkable, and you could probably just fucking ignore it, except for that she went on a TV show with an actual fascist. And did you see Richard Spencer's response to that was to say, you know, Nuts Bowl gang, question mark?
Yeah, right.
Red Brown Alliance. There it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is these things, you know, this is the reason why we have to talk about this. Like, is the British Labour Party's position on free movement, which is now, you know, in favor of some kind of controlled border. Is that fascist? I would say no. But certainly Tucker Carlson's position is pretty fascist.
Yeah.
So what's the distinction, right?
The distinction is that the British Labour Party illustrates the limits of socialism in one country, essentially, you know?
Yeah, we're...
You know, socialism within the framework of the bourgeois nation state, which is not socialism, but, you know, social democracy, whatever. You know, just so people don't, like, fucking talk shit, which, you know.
Oh, they will. It's all right.
So, speaking of not being so confused and mystified by the idea of fascist anti-capitalism, I kind of wanted to, like, start this episode off by talking about the roots of fascism, like, where it comes from. So, there is a bit of truth in the idea that when right-wingers attack fascism and say, well, fascism is just socialism. Fascism is like a bastard mutant form that comes out of socialism, but is not socialism, obviously. So we have to talk about George Sorel, who was a Marxist in the early 20th century, who proposed a fundamental alteration to Marxism, which I would actually characterize as a departure from Marxism, because he believed that the social democratic parties, all of whom claimed to be Marxist, were decadent and, you know, in need of being shaken up. So what he said was that the socialists needed to accept the free market because he thought that competition would help develop a more modern economy and sharpen the antagonisms between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. And he espoused a proletarian culture of voluntarism, which would sort of recognize the importance of moral and emotional forces and the motivating power of idealism and myth. And he said that rationalism and materialism should be eschewed in favor of a belief in heroism, sacrifice, and asceticism. So you're already starting to hear hints of fascism coming in there, right?
Yeah, that all sounds really, really right-wing already.
So he believed in a complete rejection of parliamentarism and liberal democracy in favor of direct action. He thought that Marx couldn't have seen the concessions that the reformist bourgeoisie would be willing to make to maintain peace, and that peace must be broken by the proletariat. He said that there is a moral character of violence, and violence would be a means by which a new revolutionary proletarian consciousness could be formed. He believed it generated a sense of seriousness and solidarity and saw violence as a necessary creative force that produced a transformative benefit.
Okay, but...
And, of course, that's not unique to fascism.
I was going
to
say, that sounds like it could come out of the pages of Fanon as well.
Exactly, and I think there are, like, some parallels between one of Sorel's essays on violence and Fanon's ideas of violence as well, which I think that we could probably talk about. So Sorel's theories had the largest effect on the syndicalists of Italy, who took up his call and emphasized the importance of creating proletarian mythos, aesthetic, and a system of symbols and emotional appeals. Now, Sorelianism is a small but vital part of what makes Italian fascism fascism. So these Italian Sorelians, the syndicalists, of which there was a significant movement at the time, had left the Italian Socialist Party and withdrawn from the predominantly socialist trade union federation. One of their key theorists, Arturo Labriola, had seen the discrimination and exploitation of Italian workers abroad, and he sort of developed a notion of Italy as a proletarian nation, which must engage in a national revolutionary transformation to secure its place in the world. So...
Interesting.
There you see echoes of third worldism.
Mm-hmm.
So, like the orthodox Marxists, they believed that Italian socialism could not be achieved without the development of capitalism, and that it was necessary to form a cross-class revolutionary movement which incorporated peasants, the productive middle class, and the working class. and like other major capitalist countries, Italy would need its own colonies from which to extract wealth. They emphasized the importance of structure and organization, and of course took up violence and voluntarism, and placed heavy emphasis on a system of symbols and a positivist, non-materialist morality to motivate the working class to action. They proposed a corporatist system in which the free market forces of capitalism could accumulate the necessary wealth for future collectivism while mitigating the exploitation of the working class. So this pluralist state would provide like the surest way for the modernization necessary for the transition to socialism. By 1911, the Italians fought a war with the Ottoman Empire to conquer the territory of Libya, and the revolutionary syndicalists, who I would probably better think would better be called the national syndicalists at this point, supported the war as an assertion of the power of a proletarian nation against a backwards empire, which would bring modernization to a backwards region. So, I mean, let's see, like 8 years later, the national syndicalists would make up the core of the fascist party. So you could see there like this slow transition where they started off Marxist and made little tweaks here and there to Marxism, and then eventually just turned right wing. The key pivoting point there is the nationalism aspect of it.
So they,
and the cross class collaboration, which, you know.
Yeah, they made revisions, you might say.
They made revisions. Oh. Yeah, it really, when you start looking at third world nationalisms, there's a very, very fine line between those and fascism, because Spanish fascism and Italian fascism initially didn't have a racial component. There were Jews that were fascists. There were eventually fascism developed its more sort of biological racism because of Nazism, because of its relationship to Nazism. But there was some racism involved in the colonialism of Italy in general that fascism inherited. But like if you start looking at the Baathists, they look almost identical to fascist regimes on paper, which is why I think that so many of the fascists love Bashar al-Assad.
Yeah, like the block of four classes. The concept of like a proletarian nation, it sounds like later era Maoism in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And, as we go through this stuff, we'll definitely see where there is some affinity between the two movements, specifically in the post-Francis Parker Yaki fascist milieu. Looking at protests in France while thinking about Sorel is a smart thing to do, you know? Thinking about Frantz Fanon and Sorel and protests in France, like, makes sense. And that you can see that on the ground in France, there are rightists and leftists who have similar goals, who are participating in similar actions. Neoliberalism has inadvertently united elements of the far right and the far left in the streets of France right now. I'm not calling that a red-brown alliance. I'm calling that like the proletarian rage just erupting. And what that turns into, who can say at this point, you know?
Yeah, a red-brown alliance is like a conscious decision. What was really interesting in doing a lot of the reading for this conversation is actually how frequent red-brown alliances have been throughout the whole last, through the whole history of the movement.
So the history of like Marxism and socialism in general, you know?
Yeah, the way that I think probably a lot more benign, like the Russian Bolsheviks seeking to put themselves at the head of a movement, and that then invariably meant like being in conversation with and making agreements with groups to their right, to much...
Like the SRs.
Yeah, like the SRs. Or like I read some stuff today that I don't know if it can be verified, that like there were occasional agreements with the Black Hundreds or with nationalist groups in places like Ukraine or whatever. And then there's even, like, I read about the KPD making, like, you know, temporary agreements with the Nazis in the, like, early, you know, before the Nazis took power. Well, that just seems like really bad strategy there.
Well, the Prussian NSDAP was much more radical than the rest of the country, specifically the Bavarian, where National Socialist Party, where Hitler had his base. And that's where Gregor Strasser was the leader. The head of the Berlin SA was Walter Stennis, who, once he left Germany, spied for Stalin in China. The Berlin SA and the Prussian SA would engage in strike actions and would coordinate their strike actions with the Communist Party. And that happened a bunch of times. Eventually, the Prussian SA was sort of told to chill out by the party, by Hitler specifically. And that was right before the party purged itself of its more socialistic elements and then gained power and then killed off the rest of them.
Yeah, I mean, it seems kind of like that maybe the hope of the communists at the time was to, like, peel away sections of, you know, not the Nazi Party's support base, but actually of its active, like, membership, which...
Well, that definitely was their plan.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, you know, it's not like a bunch of dudes you'd really want in your party.
Right. I mean, so there was a faction within the German Communist Party of National Bolsheviks, and that's where the term originally comes from, was in Germany at the time. Like, Ernst Niekisch saw that the best way forward for Germany as a nation was to adopt a Bolshevik model. They believed in creating Soviets and having workers' councils and having a fully Soviet economy. Absolutely just exactly like Russia, but have national German sovereignty. And they believed in waging a war of proletarian nationalism against the people that were occupying portions of Germany, like Poland and France, and, you know, throwing out the British and American and French influence.
So that's not altogether different from the SRs and Brest-Litovsk and, like, wanting to take the war,
right?
You know, to, like, liberate the lands occupied by the German army or whatever.
Yeah, at the time, they were sort of... I could see being a German worker and being confused by the line that the Communist Party and the Comintern and the German Communist Party were taking, because they would switch back and forth between, like, adopting national Bolshevik talking points and then, you know, eschewing them, and then adopting them, and then eschewing them, and then, you know, welcoming Nazis into the party and then kicking out people that were too nationalistic. And it was just like this one article that I read, which I'll link in the show notes, sort of talks about Comintern policy during this period. It's just kind of makes you dizzy looking at how often they would switch their positions. I think that their appeals to nationalism and their cozying up to the Nazis here and there is probably what made it so easy for so many communists to join the Nazi Party en masse after it was outlawed.
Yeah.
You know, that there was a saying that, well, they called these people beefsteak Nazis that were, you know, brown on the outside, but red on the inside, because there were so many communists that joined the Sturmabteilung.
Sorry, I was trying to come up with a joke for beefcake Nazis. I was just laughing at the word, and I never even formulated the joke.
Okay, so, like, the basis that all further sort of national Bolshevik and fascist anti-capitalism is, like, built on, and probably the most inspiring figure for these people, is that of Otto Strasser and Strasserism, which was the natural radicalization of the kind of German socialism or Prussian socialism that Oswald Spengler promoted in the past, and that so many of the conservative revolutionaries of Germany at the time sort of championed. Strasserism is what everybody who disagrees with identity politics gets called.
Oh, yeah.
They get called Strasserites now.
Yeah. No, it's so true. The term Strasserite gets thrown around a whole lot in DSA right now.
It does. And from what I've seen, it's because nobody knows what the fuck it is. So,
well, because cool everyone sends them to the same, like, Tumblr article that someone wrote that doesn't actually have any historical references, that is just like, this is what it is, and trust me.
Well, yeah, I mean, the confusion about that question is linked to the bigger confusion about the question of the nation as a concept that seems to have plagued, you know, it's plagued us longer than DSA's been around, for sure. Like, the concept of nationhood is a thing that exists in people's minds, and like, what we've seen, what we saw all throughout the 20th century is, you know, proletarian internationalism butting up against and sometimes, you know, intersecting with the question of nationalism, and basically just us getting it wrong a lot of the time. I don't think it's like feasible. It's not realistic, or it isn't the case that every time there's been a working class uprising and like revolt against capital, that it has fully understood itself as an expression of a global movement for the abolition of national borders and of cultural distinctions or whatever, you know, and like, or even the abolition of class, right? So it's one of those like mixed up ideas that floats around in people's heads. It's like, people make the revolution because they're patriots, just as much as because they, you know, believe that you know, they're good Christians or whatever.
So right.
The bigger question seems to be more like, in the form of the Workers' Party, does the political leadership have the capacity to navigate that effectively?
So that kind of reminds me of Nikolai Ustroyalov. You know, he was a white that fled Russia. And once the NEP started, he saw that the Bolsheviks were kind of like what he called normalizing things in Russia, you know, and decided that the Bolsheviks were the last hope for Russian greatness. And he adopted national Bolshevism. He published a paper called Smenovik. The Russian national Bolsheviks were called Smenovikites. Anyway, Smenovikites? Whatever. But anyway, so like, he basically inspired a lot of Russian emigres that were whites to sort of go back to Russia and become good communists.
Good communists.
Good communists, quote unquote. And a funny thing is, like, 2 years later, Stalin had him killed.
Not necessarily because of anything to do with like a disagreement with the idea of like great Russian patriotism and even great Russian chauvinism as being like a useful political tool, right? Because like,
oh no, because Stalin absolutely adopted great Russian chauvinism.
Yeah, I mean the whole socialism in one country, political victory inside the Communist Party, the sort of Russification, like the reassertion of like Russification as like a method of political control. I don't know. The modern day national Bolsheviks look back at that as like, oh, that was when the like cosmopolitan globalist communism of Trotsky lost out to the like Russian spiritualism and national communism of Stalin, right? So like,
right.
That's why they like they regard him as like a, you know, a Stalin as like a figure in their pantheon, as opposed to like this terribly westernized degenerates. That Stalin has essentially purged in the form of all the old Bolsheviks.
Stalin had SJWs thrown in gulags.
Doesn't this more or less kind of, and a lot of what we've been talking about, kind of speak to overall the problems and reactionary nature of Stalinism? You know, I think that one of the best examples of that is, you know, that the USSR was the second country to recognize Israel as a Jewish state and then stopped giving a shit about them when they sided with Western interests. Yes. And then that's when we saw a huge rise in anti-Semitism. Well, not we, but, you know, some other old motherfuckers
like in the USSR?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stalin definitely utilized Russian patriotism during World War II. You know, it was, they still call World War II the Great Patriotic War. And then at that point, Stalin loosened restrictions on the Orthodox Church, because it was so much a part of Russian culture. And basically just stoked up all this old Russian nationalism that had been tamped down by the Bolsheviks. And then after that, it kind of just blossomed and just was like a wildfire.
I mean, even the like the national anthem of the USSR, like they change it, right? They change it from the Internationale, which is the, you know, the unites the human race. And they switch it to the Unbreakable Union of Freeborn Republics. Great Russia has welded forever to stand. It's like they like make a conscious, like overt move to be like, oh, this is a cool thing about Russia that we're doing over here.
Interesting that you mentioned the spike in anti-Semitism in Russia, Jenny. I don't necessarily know if it coincides with Israel or not. I'm not sure, but I definitely know that the doctor's plot, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, where Stalin had a bunch of doctors arrested,
yeah,
in Moscow, a bunch of Jewish doctors, because there was perceived plot to overthrow Stalin that all these doctors were involved in.
Well, I don't know that necessarily one led to the other, but certainly, you know, it gave some form of justification.
I mean, I think you're right that it coincides, like not necessarily that there's a direct cause and effect relationship between those two moments, but they do happen at like more or less the same time, and they play out as part of like the Cold War, right?
Yeah, which is a super weird and interesting time when you're looking at fascism. So there's this guy Francis Parker Yockey, who is sort of the godfather of modern fascism, and he sees like the doctor's plot as Russia breaking with its Jewish Bolshevik past and fully embracing a sort of national Bolshevism. And he writes this book and travels around Europe. It's called Imperium. He travels around Europe, like, handing it out to people and trying to forge a fascist international, which is kind of a funny thing to think about. An international of nationalists?
Yeah.
But he believed that the USSR, Stalin's USSR, was national Bolshevik. And that was preferable to, you know, the consumerist, degenerate American West. Because if you look at Stalin's Russia, the 1930s saw a reimposition of traditional culture, of Russian traditional culture. That's when homosexuality was recriminalized, divorce was made more difficult again. While saying all of this, all of that stuff was criminalized in the rest of the world as well. And things were terrible for women as well in the rest of the world.
¿Cómo se dice the name of the person you're talking about?
Francis Parker Yockey.
Okay, so didn't he see like the issue with American capitalism, or one of them, I guess, being the influences of like non-European cultures?
Yes.
So isn't that,
that was
part of why that brand of fascism is more driven by like a cultural disagreement or hatred than a biological one?
Yeah, he was sort of one of the first people that comes out of Nazism. Okay. Like he definitely sided with the Nazis politically, and you know, argued at the he was a lawyer at the Nuremberg trials, and he argued so much that the trials were biased against the Nazis and that they weren't fair that he got that he got fired. But so he comes out of that agreeing. He had ties with the German American Bund too. So he was a Nazi. And then
how did he get a position as a? How did he have any role in the Nuremberg trials, having a political connection to the neo-Nazi, or not neo-Nazi, but the Nazis?
Don't you know that everything is bullshit?
He was in the military.
That's true. It is that.
He was in the military, I guess. So I guess that was, you know, he took part of the war effort, so I guess that was wiping the slate clean for him. But anyway, so like, you know, he comes out of that and goes to Europe, meets with all these different neo-fascists and, you know, national Bolsheviks and neo-Strasserites, and decides that he's against biological racism.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah. and starts promoting cultural racism instead.
Well, like,
but yeah,
they, I mean, that's the, I was, you know, in the National Bolshevik platform or whatever, they like talk a lot about like a you know, vehement rejection of like race hatred and like biological notions of supremacy or whatever. But then they
publicly, but privately,
the new National Bolshevik platform.
Yeah,
the German National Bolshevik platform.
No, no, the Russian National
Bolshevik. We haven't like made that clear that there's two distinctly separate groups of people. There's the National Bolshevik Front in Russia that formed in the 90s, and then there's the National Bolsheviks of Germany.
Oh, word.
And then there's, you know, National Bolshevik ideology or whatever.
Okay, this is what I don't get about people who, like, throw around terms really carelessly. Or, like, it makes sense to, like, speak clumsily, and I'm sure I have and will several times while talking about fascism, because it's really hard to wrap your mind around, especially when things aren't just, like, super black and white the way people present them. Just like they're racist and they like capitalism, you know, that's clearly not what we're talking about. What blows my mind is like the confidence with which people can throw around terms like fascism and Strasserite. I'm like, I can't speak super confidently about any of this because everything is fucking me the fuck up. So it's just really weird and maybe irresponsible.
Well, it's intellectually super lazy. And it's also because I think like there is a lack of recognition that there are people in the socialist movement who have like rightist tendencies, which, you know, are things that I think we should struggle against, right? They have like right leaning ideas about this or that particular thing, but you know, to be a Strasserite, right, or to be a Nazbol, is to like to be a proponent of a political vision for the world which is distinct and opposed to the one that we're advocating, right?
Yeah.
So like a person who has like a conservative bent on a question that, you know, otherwise is like a socialist, like a Marxist. Well, I'm just saying that they should be regarded as distinct phenomena, you know?
We should give listeners a working definition of Strasserism, because so far all we've said is Strasserism.
Oh, yeah.
And talked about how people don't know what it is. So.
Just put a link to someone's shitty tweet about it in the show notes that everyone's referencing.
It's not our job to educate you.
Well, we're not getting paid for this, so it's definitely not our job.
Literally, I have a very different job that I just came
from. Okay. So, Strasserism is essentially the ideas of Otto Strasser, who was one of two brothers, Otto and Gregor Strasser, both of whom were members of the Nazi Party. Gregor was there first. He was a member of the Nazi Party for a lot longer than Otto was, and he stayed a lot longer after Otto left. I think Otto was only a member of the Nazi Party for 4 years, and then he was inspired by Ernst Nakisch's National Bolsheviks to leave and start what was called the Black Front. So the Black Front is the first time you get a distinctly Strasserite movement. And the Strasserites were national socialists. He left the Nazi Party because he wasn't a Nazi. Not really. He didn't give a shit about biological racism. He didn't give a shit about any of the mysticism. He was a Christian, you know. He didn't care about all the weird sort of Aryan mysticism that Hitler and Himmler believed in. He wanted, let's see, like a European Union type of formation, of which Germany was just one nation. And he's where you get this, the Strasserites are where you get this idea of ethno-pluralism, which is distinct, separate, but not necessarily unequal cultures, you know.
Yeah, we have that too.
He's essentially, you know, a German chauvinist. He believes that Germans should be in Germany, and if you're not going to be a German, you should leave Germany. He specifically would say things like, Jews can stay in Germany as long as they speak German and they don't practice their culture as a nation, which is racism. Ethnic superiority, that's racism.
Yeah, he was still a Nazi Semite. He just...
Right.
You know, he wasn't like Goebbels.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
He was kind of alt-light.
Strasser was alt-light. He specifically spoke out against anti-Semitism, but then practiced soft anti-Semitism, you know, as one does when they're a Strasserite.
Well, and but, as did a lot of people in the USSR, you know?
Right, so Strasser was definitely for a much more radical version of German socialism, this idea of German socialism. He wanted to keep a small amount of free trade, but completely nationalize the means of production. Essentially, just have a managerial class that existed that became part of a managerial class by nature of their hard work, sort of a meritocracy, you know?
So it's kind of like if you advocated for, like, the temporary, you know, the retreat in the form of the NEP, only you thought it would be really cool if it just stayed forever.
Another big breaking point of Otto Strasser from the Nazis is he absolutely opposed the Führerprinzip, you know, the idea of the great leader, which makes him distinctly different than the rest of the fascists, you know, because all the rest of the fascist movements had that Führer, Caudillo, Duce kind of figure as a key point. And he actually believed in democracy, authoritarian democracy, but democracy of some sort. And rule by a system of councils, which wouldn't look too much different than Russia in the late 20s. So that's Strasserism, ethno-nationalism and socialism, a form of socialism.
Well, it seems like the sort of obsession with the concept of like the integrity of the nation.
Right.
It's like it's a thing that hasn't been like exorcised. It's a demon that hasn't been exorcised from like the petty bourgeoisie in Germany at this point, right? Like, and I guess it's something that I guess it sort of reasserts itself, like the ideology of nationalism over and over again, and it's like it plays this like really profound role in a, I don't know, warping people's brains.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it's one thing, I think, to be like, you know, you can appeal to the, like, the wounded pride of, like, Germans because the French are occupying, you know,
the Ruhr.
Yeah. And to be like, yo, they shouldn't do that, right? And yeah. It's another thing to be like, once we get it back, how do we make sure those Frenchies learn to speak German? You know? Like, yeah. It becomes ideological, this idea of, like, maintaining the nation. I just couldn't imagine caring that much about, like, a country.
Yeah. So, Strasserism turns into something completely different. Not completely different. Something much more racist moving forward. Because the people that adopt Strasserism include within it a healthy dose of just Hitlerite National Socialism as well, you know?
You're talking about, like, after the war?
Yeah, after the war.
Oh, yeah, because it becomes, like the acceptable refuge for Nazis.
Like, specifically the Socialist Reich Party, which was a self-proclaimed Strasserite party, which was denied the Holocaust and was anti-Semitic openly and eventually banned by the West German state.
I read that the Socialist Reich Party had like a cozy financial relationship with the East German government, or like maybe with the Stasi anyways, because they saw the Communist Party in West Germany was like, you know, seen as a tool of Moscow or whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas the Socialist Reich Party, the East Germans saw them as like actually like a possibly effective, at least for a little bit, like, you know, basis for like a counter, for like an anti-system movement against like NATO influence over a divided country, right? That the sentiment about like wanting to bring the country back together would actually somehow work out in East Germany's favor.
So the Socialist Reich Party was known to have said that they would show the Soviets the way to the Rhine if they ever decided to invade.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they were like a Nazi party that was pro-Soviet, which is an interesting thing that happens in the Cold War, is all these neo-Nazis see the Soviet Union as National Bolshevik and become pro-Soviet. So, like, we're starting to get into the things that make the New Right what it is. And when we think about the New Right in France, which is now bleeding over into the United States, it's more sophisticated, seemingly less racist. It looks less racist. And it doesn't have visible ties to Nazism. So it slides under the radar in a lot of the countries that have laws against Nazism. And has sort of made its way into the United States in the figure of people like Richard Spencer or the now defunct Traditionalist Workers' Party. And there's also another group that, what were they called? Like New Resistance or something like that?
Oh, that was the one that's like the deep ecology national revolutionary movement that looks kind of like anarchist.
Kind of like green anarchist, yeah.
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 But they have all of this bizarre language in their literature, which is not altogether different from the stuff I read about the Strasser brothers or the stuff I read about Edward Limonov and the Russian Nazbols. It's like, yeah, it's like a hybrid sort of, I don't know, they call it a third position, right? Because it's not.
Yeah. It's called third positionism. But yeah, that comes out of this. Basically, Francis Parker Yaki went around Europe and planted little nationalism seed, like, you know, Nazbol seeds that they grew into the European New Right. But specifically, there are two thinkers. There's Jean-François Thiriard and Alain de Benoist, who are the basically godfathers of the New Right, the European New Right. So Thiriard served in the Waffen-SS, comes out of that as a pan-Europeanist. And that's something that you'll see shows up in all of the New Right's thought, is pan-Europeanism, like a European bloc of nations. So basically, like a European Union of nationalist groupings that opposes the United States. And they all adopted the same position too, of the USSR being preferable to the United States. And this is what's fucking crazy about Thiriard. He actually made ties with Ceausescu, and Ceausescu wrote for this neo-Nazi journal, essentially. He contributed articles to it.
I mean, okay. So, like, the affinity between the two, or rather, let's say, like, the way in which a person, like, you know, that has these kind of new right tendencies could see an affinity for Ceausescu, that's not surprising to me. It's the same way that a lot of people do with, like, North Korea today. Yeah. What's surprising to me is that Ceausescu wrote for his, you know, that affinity went the other way. That's kind of revelatory for me.
Yeah, I was completely unaware of this fact. So what's interesting is that, you know, the Ceausescu's government just basically swallowed up former members of the Iron Guard, Codriano's fascist grouping that was allied with Hitler, contributed troops to the invasion of the Soviet Union, and was, you know, outlawed after World War II. But they all joined the Communist Party. Probably had a whole hell of a lot to do with, you know, the Ceausescu's ideas of national communism.
Right. Like, you know, pursuing the distinct national course for Romania. Yeah, again, it's like this desire to accommodate nationalist impulses seems to be a real fucking problem with the Stalin set.
Yeah. And so Thiriard, you know, after meeting with Ceausescu, he goes on and he worked with Juan Perón as well, and tried to get funding from the Chinese. He met with I don't remember who he met with, someone high up in the Chinese government, tried to get a bunch of funding from the Chinese, and but, you know, it was unsuccessful, but, you know, to the Chinese's credit. But yeah, he, you know, praised Castro, Ho Chi Minh, and actually met with a young Colonel Saddam Hussein.
Oh.
At one point. Yeah. So what's interesting is that from this, from out of this milieu comes Alain de Benoist, who, inspired by Antonio Gramsci to sort of take a, what Gramsci said about cultural hegemony, and come up with a sort of cultural fascism, if you will, that he could propagate and publish in his journal to that aim. And he had all these same views that Yaki and Thiriard did about the USSR being better. He insisted on his ideas being beyond the false dichotomy of left and right, which is what you'll hear all fascists say, and all proto-fascists like fucking Alex Jones, and, you know.
Yeah, none of them regard themselves as conservatives and of the right.
Well, no, most of them regard themselves as conservatives, but not rightists, which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true. Like, if you think about the, like, the idea of making a, some sort of spiritual return to what, like, characterizes the national conscience, it's a pretty conservative way of looking at things, that, like, that there's something pure in the earlier forms of the society, as opposed to, you know, the ethic of communism at its, let's say, at its best, which is futurist, which is, you know, we're basically, like, we're inspired more by a vision of what could be rather than inspired by a vision of what it must have been like before.
Did you know that Derek Jensen, the one of the founders of the Deep Green Resistance, used to be a neoconservative?
Listen, I was going to bring that up at some point and ask if you knew, since you're in the belly of the beast.
And he said, quote, "That's how you get to own land, by living there and entering into that predator-prey relationship for generation after generation, and having your blood mix with the soil and the soil mix with your blood."
Oh.
Well, I don't like the sound of that.
What is Derek Jensen saying about blood and soil?
And he also thinks that it's fine to build a wall with Mexico and keep people out, so long as you also keep resources out, and you do that bioregionally rather than arbitrary national boundaries.
This is where things start getting more relevant for us, because all of the language of the new, the European New Right is what the Eurasianists of Alexander Dugin and the National Bolsheviks and, you know, Marine Le Pen's party, the National Front, and the British National Party. All of this language comes from Benoist. So he really promotes this idea of ethno-pluralism, which we've mentioned a couple of times before. And, you know, he adopts the same pan-Europeanism, like I mentioned before.
It's sort of like an Ottoman cultural policy, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, it kind of is.
I was thinking about that
when
I was reading
except
this
for
stuff.
Ottoman had... The Ottoman Empire had centralized rule, whereas this wouldn't.
Well, sure, but, like, within each, within the nation, like the Ottomans had, like, you know, yeah, sure, you could be Jewish and, like, have your independent cultural institutions and political life or whatever, but you have to pay, like, a tax. Or, like, you know, the Arab population is obviously, like, it's massive second class population within the empire, but still also is represented in, you know, in some sort of a form. But, like, you know, the Turks in the western half of the empire are clearly, like, the people that have a privileged place. Or, you know, I mean, in a less official but still pretty obvious way, it's like Soviet policy with ethnic Russians, at least in the Brezhnev era. and maybe in the Stalin era too.
So one of the things that he said was, it's better to wear the helmet of the Red Army than to live on a diet of hamburgers in Brooklyn, which was quoted in 2017 by Richard Spencer in one form, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Wait, what did Spencer say exactly?
I don't know. Look it up. Tell me.
Google is free.
Yeah, but did he say wear a helmet of the Red Army? He did say that. It's just,
what a fucking nerd. How, that's not even relevant. There's no goddamn Red Army anymore.
Yeah, it's just a picture of Richard Spencer, like, that he probably took, and he's smoking, and it says, better to wear a Red Army helmet than subsist on a diet of hamburgers in Brooklyn. This comment somebody left, you can always stop eating hamburgers, but you cannot un-genocide whites genocided by Jewish Red Army.
I would love it if the Jewish Red Army genocided whites.
Well, I was going to say, like,
make me so happy.
It's to the credit of the Jewish Red Army. You can't ungenocide any of those genocided whites.
That's what permanent revolution means.
Hell yeah.
That's right. I mean, you know, in the third positionist, you know, understanding of the world, that is what permanent revolution means. That's what Trotsky stood for, is genociding
the whites. I wasn't joking.
Yeah, no, I'm into it. Let's do it.
Yeah, we might as well.
Yeah, that's why I'm a post-Trotskyist, because I've moved past the idea of needing to genocide the whites so much as just put them in gulags.
Oh, okay. That's fair.
Yeah.
We're talking about, like, a cultural policy of,
cleansing.
Exclusion of the whites, culturally.
Post-Trotskyist doesn't have the same ring as Post Malone, but I bet you'll make better music.
Yeah, probably. Okay, so... Speaking of third positionism, I was interested to find out that the Italian group Terza Posizione set off a bomb in Bologna and injured 200 people and killed like 30-something people.
Yeah, but come on, like, everybody was blowing people up in the 80s.
I know, for real, right? But so, out of this group, a bunch of people flee to the UK and start hanging out with people like Nick Griffin and Derek Holland. That's where the National Front comes from, was that through this interaction with third positionists from Italy.
You mean the British National Party?
No, the National Front in Britain is the precursor of the British National Party.
Oh, okay, I see.
Yeah. Well, there's also a National Front in France now, which is Marine Le Pen's party. There's National Fronts all over the place. Some of them are communist. Some of them aren't. So from that grouping comes International Third Position, and Nick Griffin splits out of that and joins the British National Party. And then Troy Southgate, who I guess if you're familiar with British rightism or the idea of national anarchism, Troy Southgate is the guy who creates that idea.
What a, like, you know, I mean, you know, so like national socialism seems like a really half-formed idea, and national Bolshevism seems like are just two different ideas, like, utterly glommed onto each other. And then national anarchism seems like an intentional contradiction.
It's because of the way that we understand the idea of nations. Yeah. We understand nations and the idea of the bourgeois nation state, and not like the way that Europeans have understood nations as being one ethnicity.
Blood,
oh, right.
And soil.
You know?
Yeah,
that's true.
Like Derek Jensen.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's this group, which I watched a little short documentary about recently called Casa Pound, that has come up out of this third position movement. It looks like an anarchist sort of commune. Like they own a compound, and they bring in like homeless kids and, you know, indoctrinate them in fascism and let them live there. And then they all live communally. Then they go and harass immigrants and stuff like that.
Wow, that's like really a one step forward, two steps back kind of stuff there. Dude, actually, that's an interesting conversation.
That's a super interesting idea.
You're telling me, Butterino?
Answer.
Oh, I'm sorry. So don't say Butterino if you're not white. My bad. I'm sorry.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Are you trying to
taking your culture?
My culture?
quit appropriating Kevin's culture.
It's Kevin's culture.
Yeah.
My because he's not from South Texas.
My family hails from one of the degenerate races.
Yeah, we're fucking slobs, so sure. We're subhuman.
I'm mostly Irish and English and some Northern European.
Yikes.
Oh yeah, so you're fucking Aryan.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
Yeah, you're gonna be white genocided.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. I'm only gonna be white excluded.
Yeah, that's post-Trotsky.
Like Meek Mill said, there are levels to this shit.
Yeah.
Y'all don't know who Meek Mill is, it's okay.
Oh!